In no particular order, Netflix, big banks, credit cards in China, and honestly, your guess is as good as mine on that Brexit story. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Tuesday, today, it is the 15th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are, give or take, 2.5 years into the saga that is Brexit, Great Britain pulling out of the European Union. And it is not going too far at all, I think, to say that we are no closer today to knowing how this thing is going to turn out than we were when the Brits voted in the summer of 2016. Prime Minister Theresa May's proposed withdrawal deal took a drubbing in Parliament today. It went down 432 to 202, which means, well, who knows? So as we do when Brexit news rolls around, we got a hold of Stephen Beard in London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So honestly, now what happens?
Well, the deal, Theresa May's deal, is as dead as a dodo. I mean, this was an absolutely shattering defeat. She lost the vote by a bigger margin than anyone predicted. I mean, what happened here today was that Remainers and Brexiteers united to trash this deal. And this was May's flagship policy. It's astonishing, frankly, that she hasn't resigned.
All right. So, well, and there's going to be a no confidence vote, I guess, at some point tomorrow from Labour's Jeremy Corbyn, right?
Yes, that's right. That's okay. Going to be debated tomorrow. Yeah. Now, if she lost that, she surely would resign, and it could very well collapse the government and could lead to a general election. But in fact, actually, what I should say is she's probably likely to survive that confidence vote, because her Brexit rebels and members of the Northern Irish Party that were propping her up don't want the government to collapse. So from tomorrow, she could, you know, be soldiering on trying to extract a better deal from the EU.
All right. But look, if you are, first of all, a British business, or second of all, an overseas or international business thinking about doing business in Great Britain in the short to medium term future, what are you thinking right now?
Well, they've probably been thinking this for some while, actually. Yeah. I mean, businesses really must be getting used to this uncertainty. Nevertheless, one thing from which they might derive some encouragement, and this possibly a reason for the pound actually ticking up today, counterintuitively, this may be because what could happen now is Parliament could take more control over the situation and actually start ordering the government to do certain things. For example, seeking a postponement of Brexit Day beyond March the 29th. There's even the possibility that Parliament might order a second referendum, which could result in no Brexit at all. But I guess, in a way, that might offer some comfort and reassurance to possible investors in Britain. But on the other hand, it might not. It looks as if there's going to be a lot of turmoil and confusion here over the next few weeks.
Last thing, and we got to hustle before I let you go. If you're the European Union looking at this, the EU27, as they call themselves, what are you thinking?
Well, the EU has been playing hardball over this, trying to punish Britain to discourage other member states from leaving. But the EU doesn't want a no-deal Brexit either. I mean, the EU's got a $90 billion trade surplus with Britain. If the UK does crash out on March the 29th without a deal, French wine growers, German car makers and Spanish farmers are going to be up in arms. And with Germany and Italy almost certainly in recession now, France not far behind, the mess of a no-deal Brexit is the last thing that the EU needs.
Stephen Beard in London on kind of an amazing geopolitical and economic day. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Kai.
Stephen was talking about the pound there and how it rose against the dollar after the vote. Priced in is the phrase you're looking for. Everybody knew May was going to lose and was selling, or were, I suppose, is what you ought to say. They were selling their pounds in advance of that vote. All right, back here, speaking of selling and buying, JPMorgan Chase reported weaker than expected profits this morning after a mixed report from Citigroup yesterday. To be clear, they both made billions of dollars, but there was a theme in both reports that is likely to be repeated through the week. Trading divisions at the Wall Street banks are showing some big declines from a year ago because it turns out trading desks all over Wall Street have had a tough quarter. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains why.
Congress limited banks from certain types of risky trading after the financial crisis. But Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics says banks still do a lot of trading for themselves. And
banks also act as traders for clients and then earn fees for doing so.
When markets are shaky and trading picks up, banks can rake it in. In fact, trading desk revenue jumped at the beginning of 2018 when we saw some volatility. But Wells Fargo Bank analyst Mike Mayo says not all volatility is created equal.
Well, look, there's good volatility and bad volatility. If there's too little, there's not much incentive to trade. If there's too much, people get scared.
Mayo says trading froze up last quarter because banks' trading clients found plenty of reasons to freak out.
You can go down the list. Trade, interest rates, currencies, volatility, Brexit, EU, China, Mexico, NAFTA, U.S. politics, government shutdown, and the stock market. You had the biggest stock market decline in 7 years.
The stock market wasn't the only thing hurting trading revenue. Big banks are also big issuers of corporate bonds. Hillary Kramer, chief investment officer at A&G Capital, says corporate bonds have not been selling well.
It's very challenging for the banks today to make money on trading, especially banks like J.P. Morgan and Citigroup that are originators of bonds.
J.P. Morgan reported that bond trading revenue sank by 16%. Citigroup's bond revenue dropped by 21%. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Weaker than expected, J.P. Morgan's profits might have been, but they still cleared $7 billion American dollars the last 3 months of 2018. So, which way do you think shares went? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. From the wires this afternoon, Dateline Washington, D.C., credit the Associated Press, quote, IRS is recalling 46,000 workers, nearly 60% of its workforce, from furlough to handle tax refunds without pay. I mention that because of a story I read in the Washington Post today, which points out that for some in the Trump administration, a government shutdown is not the worst thing in the world. Lisa Ryan shared the byline on that story. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
We should say at the outset here that the Trump administration has been trying to reduce the size of the federal government since the get-go.
Oh, absolutely. Trump campaigned on smaller government, as many Republicans do. But I think in his case, he talked about deconstructing the administrative state. This was about regulations. This was about the size of government. This was about, you know, bringing the bureaucracy of the federal government to heel. And there are many agencies where in the past 2 years, civil servants have either retired or just quit and found other jobs because the culture shift that Trump brought in just wasn't what they wanted.
And now here we are on day 25 of a shutdown that, as you report in the paper today, along with some other people, there are folks around the president who think maybe the shutdown is not the worst thing in the world and it's a way to get to a smaller government.
That's right. So these are people like Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, former South Carolina congressman, member of the Tea Party movement. Remember the Tea Party? They've sort of morphed into the Freedom Caucus in the House of Representatives. It's not that they don't care about a wall on the border, but they care more about smaller government. They want less federal spending. Mm-hmm. They want fewer bureaucrats. And they feel that the shutdown has shown them something, which is we haven't collapsed. Vital services are still getting to Americans. Maybe this shows us that we can function with a smaller government.
To that point, though, about vital services getting where they need to be, what's actually happening is that the White House is arranging workarounds so that the pain or the dysfunction of a smaller government is not really being felt. Like, for instance, the IRS refunds, right? They've created that workaround calling people in to make sure those tax refunds get out.
So politically, they realize that there's a fallout of a shutdown of this duration. And so what they need to do is, try to protect Trump, from that fallout. So it's the tax refunds. And now what we're actually seeing even today is that the FAA has brought back thousands of FAA workers. It's partly that they have to bring people back and call them essential employees because otherwise government really will stop functioning. And then, so there's that group. And then there's another group of people who, you know, they're trying to help, like people who go to national parks. They brought back the people who maintain the parks just to keep those services going and Americans not getting upset about them not having them.
This is kind of an amazing question to have to ask. And full disclosure here, I worked for the federal government for 12 years, 8 years in the military and 4 years in the Foreign Service. But I am almost at a loss to explain why the federal government would be a good career choice at this point.
That's actually what I have heard a lot, too. And in fact, the last paragraph of our story quotes a public affairs professor in Portland, Oregon, who teaches all these students who want to go into state, local, county government. And, you know, he's telling them, look, I just don't think this is what you want to do right now. But here's what I will say. There are a lot of people currently in government who are in two categories. One is they're going to go to agencies where the missions have not changed dramatically, or they will be people who say, we're going to wait it out. And don't forget, there are Republicans in government who appreciate what Trump is doing. You know, the Defense Department, Department of Veterans Affairs, these tend to be more conservative-leaning agencies.
Lisa Ryan is a national reporter for The Washington Post covering the federal government, writing most recently with Bob Costa and Danielle Paquette about the shutdown and the ever-shrinking federal government. Lisa, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
A story now about the price elasticity of demand, but also, and thankfully less wonkily, about how you gotta spend money to make money. Netflix said today it's raising prices for all of its streaming plans in the United States. That's for both new and existing customers. The most popular HD streaming option is going to go to $13 now. That's from $11. It's been about a year and a half since the last increase. And back then, CEO Reed Hastings said he had to raise prices to cover the massive investment that Netflix is making in original content. So, as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, at least he's consistent, huh?
Netflix makes a lot of popular shows and movies, like Stranger Things and Bird Box. It also makes some stuff you've probably never heard of. Raise your hand if you've seen Disjointed, a sitcom about hijinks in a cannabis dispensary. Either way, that stuff's expensive to make. Jason Squire teaches the business of movies at USC.
$13 billion, $14 billion in annual expenses on content.
Netflix makes more than 700 original shows and movies. Tuna Amobi is a media and entertainment analyst at CFRA.
They kind of felt like the content offering can maybe justify another price increase, and we think this one will go fairly smoothly given all of the strides that they've made and investments.
In October, Netflix issued $2 billion in bonds to pay for shows and movies. Matteo Arena at Marquette University says Netflix can't afford to do that again.
At this point, the only other way they can finance new content is to either issue equity with stock or be asking consumers to pay a little more.
How much longer will customers be willing to do that? Jason Squire at USC says some people are going to get more price sensitive as Netflix and other streaming services charge more.
At what point do they converge so that a cable subscriber stays where they are and does not add a lot of streaming services?
Networks and studios are also starting to pull their content back from Netflix as their licensing deals expire. Yet another challenge for a company that's bent on getting bigger and bigger. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
There is another media story this week, media in the more traditional sense, I suppose. Digital First Media, that's a company controlled by a hedge fund called Alden Global Capital, is offering $1.3 billion to buy Gannett, the publisher of USA Today, the Detroit Free Press, and more than a dozen other newspapers. And Alden's not the only group interested in picking up pieces of the struggling local news business. Marketplace's Amy Scott looks into what investors see in the dead tree medium that has been struggling just about since the day Craigslist went online.
Despite what you might have heard,
it turns out that newspapers are still very profitable.
That's media analyst Ken Doctor with Newsonomics. Yes, newspapers overall are shrinking as ad revenue and circulation continue to fall. But Doctor estimates out of more than 1,300 dailies in the country, at least 95% of them are still in the black.
if you continue to cut costs, you got a lot of cash flow coming out of these businesses.
And cutting costs is what Digital First Media and its majority owner, Alden Global Capital, are known for. Last spring, journalists gathered outside Alden's headquarters in New York to protest layoffs and other cuts. Joe Rubino is a business reporter at DFM's Denver Post, which cut its newsroom staff by 30% last year.
They're finding a fresh carcass to light on, would be my guess. If I was working at Gannett Paper and this sale were to go through, I would really be concerned about the future.
Gannett's stock is relatively cheap, and its CEO just announced his retirement without an obvious successor. Media analyst Rick Edmonds with the Poynter Institute says that makes the company an attractive target for Digital First Media.
They might have a different approach with a company as well-established as Gannett, but I wouldn't necessarily bet on that.
Digital First didn't respond to interview requests. Gannett says it's reviewing the offer. In Denver, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, Brexit? Yep. Shutdown? Yep. Also, how small and medium-sized businesses are feeling about the year to come. Spoiler alert, not so great. Coming up.
iPhone growth is slowing, so they need to rely on these other growing revenue streams like App Store fees.
Apple's App Store dilemma. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 0.6% today, about 155 points, 24,065. The NASDAQ grew 1.7%, 117 points, 7,023. The S&P 500, 1% to the positive, 27 points, 26 and 10 there. As we told you earlier, looking like a volatile fourth quarter for the big banks. J.P. Morgan Chase announced it missed expectations, as I told you. But here's the answer to the question. Shares up 0.7%. Netflix got a nice bump off the news it's going to raise prices. Shares tacked on 6.5%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.71%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. 6 years ago, which is fundamentally a different geologic era when you are talking about the global economy. 6 years ago, the World Trade Organization ruled that foreign credit card companies should be able to operate freely in China. Still hasn't happened, but as Marketplace's Jennifer Pack reports, were Visa or MasterCard or Amex to finally be given entry, they might find the market has already passed them by.
I spent a few weeks in the U.S. recently, and I can get by with just a credit card, even if it's to pay a few dollars for a baggage cart at the airport. But here in China, I don't really have a need for a credit card. Cash used to be king, but now I can leave my apartment without my wallet. Let me show you. All the shops, pubs, restaurants around here, they take mobile payment. And you really only need two to survive in China. One is Alipay from Alibaba, and the other is WeChat. Now, you hear these motorcycles. Some of them are taxis. And, oh, here's my regular guy. 你好, 好久没见了。在那里怎么样?对对对对对,新家路,有空吗? At a stoplight, my driver Zhang Xiaoping asked me to pay.
微信纸。
He prefers WeChat Pay. He holds out his cell phone with a QR payment code. I scan it with my WeChat app, enter the amount, password, and it's done. And that's how most of his customers pay him.
Paying by WeChat is convenient. If you give me cash, it's more troublesome to find change for you.
Okay, 好,谢谢,谢谢,再见。那为什么是这个颜色?这个没有头。
Oh. Mobile payment is even an option at my local veggie and fish market. Then there's this unmanned convenience store, like any other, but with self-checkout.
Okay, let me see. It says, please scan your goods. All right. You see, the mode of payment, they're not even offering anything other than mobile payment. So you have WeChat or Alipay.
Mobile payment has exploded in China, way more than in the U.S., Americans use mobile payment for more than $100 billion worth of transactions in 2016. But that same year in China, we're talking about $23 trillion,
33-year-old Hu Jianli says he uses mobile payment for pretty much everything.
I don't have any cash on me right now, not even a penny.
Even this street performer from northeastern China in an online video accepts mobile payment. He displays a QR code so passersby can throw some money into his virtual hat. Most people link their mobile payment apps to their bank accounts. It's possible to use a credit card, but only one out of two people in China has a credit card. Americans, on average, have more than two each. College student Cheng Zhao says he barely uses his.
I only use my credit card when I need to buy expensive things like a watch or a cell phone, and I can accumulate some points by using it.
The last time he used his credit card, 4 months ago. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
It's been barely 10 years since the Apple App Store opened its virtual doors. And in the decades since, the App Store industry, which is a very real thing, has exploded. The Apple App Store and Google Play together were, and this is just in 2018, a $101 billion industry worldwide. Apple takes a 30% fee for most of the purchases made in its App Store, 30%, which has app developers, consumers, and some big companies crying foul. Shira Ovide is a tech columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. She wrote about this just the other day. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
30%? Are you kidding me with the App Store?
Yeah, it sounds like a lot, right? So
well, yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Usurious is a lot. But that's part of the gripe, right? Because the App Store is a closed environment and companies in many regard have no option but to pay the 30%.
Yes, that's exactly true. And I should say that it's 30% in many cases, but both Apple and Google have recently started to charge a 15% commission for subscription services if people stick with it for a year or longer. But still, it's a significant percentage, and you're starting to hear more and more gripes about it.
Well, so the question is, have they cut to that 15% because companies like Netflix and Epic Games and a bunch of other biggies are saying, this is absurd and we're going to do a workaround somehow?
Well, they cut to the 15% largely because Apple wants to push more subscriptions as opposed to this kind of pay once for an app download. And that's been particularly popular. The subscription option has been particularly popular for things like video games or streaming video services like Netflix, as you said. But yes, Apple has also faced longstanding complaints from companies big and small that they're taking too large a cut of the transactions that people make inside of apps.
Also users too, right? Because in theory, then you have these app developers jacking up the price because they're going to lose 30% off the top to Apple.
Yeah, in a way, it's funny because consumers don't really see this directly, right? If I pay $10 a month to Netflix and Netflix has to give 15 or 30% of that to Apple, I don't necessarily see that number. So in a way, we as consumers are paying more even if we're not paying that check directly to Apple or Google.
Right. Now, we should say here that there is a lawsuit pending, I guess. It's been heard by the Supreme Court about this very issue.
Yes, exactly right. So the Supreme Court heard arguments in what a group of consumers hopes will be a class action case where they're basically testing the rules of the Apple App Store and likely similar app stores.
Right.
And the issue that's under consideration here is, do consumers, do you and I, have the right to sue over the cut that these app developers are paying to Apple? And what Apple says is no. The issue here is, if this goes against Apple, the Supreme Court case, we may just see a wholesale rewriting of the functioning of the economics in app stores, which could be really interesting for consumers and maybe detrimental to the finances of Apple in particular.
Because these app stores are multi-billion dollar enterprises.
You and I, consumers, spend tens of billions of dollars every year on app stores. So we're talking about significant revenue. And again, for Apple in particular, iPhone growth is slowing, so they need to rely on these other growing revenue streams like App Store fees.
Well, to that point, Tim Cook came out, you know, a week, 2 weeks ago, whatever it was, with that letter about China and how, you know, they're hurting and they're going to rely more on services. So this is, in a way, a little bit existential for the company.
It is. Apple needs things like App Store downloads and, you know, Apple Care warranty programs and Apple Music in order to make up the lost revenue from things like people not buying as many iPhones as they used to.
This Supreme Court case, just to wrap it up, is this one of those a decision is expected by June kind of things?
Yeah, this term. Yeah. So who knows when exactly?
Fair enough. Shira Ovaday writes on technology for Bloomberg Opinion. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
This final note on the way out, the macroeconomic codicil, if you will, to Lisa Ryan's story in the Post that we were talking about how some people in and around the White House think a government shutdown isn't all bad. CNBC reports the White House has doubled its estimate of how much of a hit the economy is going to take from this thing. The new number is a 0.1% off GDP for every week the shutdown drags on. We're in week 4, so the math is pretty straightforward. Here, though, is the twist. The official government monthly report on gross domestic product, it comes from the Bureau of Economic Analysis in the Commerce Department, which is shut down. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 0.6% today. The NASDAQ up 1.7%. The S&P 500 1% to the positive. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.